We're asking everybody could bring a dish. I think Astrid's called just about everybody to see if you could bring a dish. If you haven't talked to her or signed up to bring a dish, please see her in the back of the church on your way out and make sure you get that signed up. And I think between that and some of the meats we're buying and so forth, hopefully we'll have enough food. If we don't, wouldn't that be a great problem? We run out. So we finished our series on evangelism a couple weeks ago. We spent 6 weeks on it, and we talked about, traditionally that's looked at as saving souls. So now we're going to just take some time and look at what is a soul, and what does soul mean, and what does that mean when we say a soul is saved. And I think one of the reasons we're just going to do that, and we said this last week, is because Jesus said it's the most valuable commodity that he's entrusted to us. We're only issued one, we won't get another. And he says, what would it even profit a man if he gains the whole world but lost his soul? In other words, he's given us a comparison here that it's more valuable than all the riches of the world. And what would a man give in exchange for his soul? What's interesting is, as valuable as the soul is, as the Bible tells us that the soul is, we're not real sure exactly all of what it actually is. There was a survey I mentioned last week in a book that I really owe a lot to for this series. It's called Soul Keeping by John Ortberg. And in that, he mentions a survey that was taken where they just asked people, do you know what a soul is? And they said, you know, usually if somebody asks you, you say, well, yeah, right? I mean, we all hear that word. We use it often. But then when they actually asked them to describe it, they weren't able to do it. And I think there's good reason for that. And what's interesting, after I did last week, I did get some feedback from some of you and realized that to actually define what the soul is actually, there's a lot of theological opinion and debate out there. And I think there's good reason for that, because the Bible doesn't give us a totally comprehensive definition of what the soul is. It's mentioned all throughout the Bible, but it doesn't necessarily give us exactly a definition of what it is. One description that I do like, I don't consider it the end-all, be-all description that I used last week, was by Dallas Willard. And the way he described it is he used these concentric circles. And in the center, he had our will, which could also be considered the heart, our ability to choose. We have this ability to say yes and this ability to say no. And then the next circle out was our mind, our thoughts, and our feelings. And then the next circle is our body. That's where we can actually carry out and put into action our thoughts, our feelings, and our choices. And then around all of that was the soul. Now, he doesn't necessarily mean that all of these things are incorporated within the soul, but what he means is that the soul is what integrates all of these things into an entire person, that makes it into a single whole life. He kind of compares it to the program of a computer that helps all the parts run together, and you're not even really aware of the program unless it messes up. And then you call Mike, right? But that's kind of how he looks at it. Like sometimes we'll even refer to maybe a particular player on a team as being the soul of the team. Like maybe for years we might have said, oh, Derek Jeter was the soul of the New York Yankees. And the idea is that it points to a notion of the soul of which it holds a larger entity together. The soul is what integrates and holds it all together. And the soul obviously seeks to take those things and connect us with God. And it's so much more deeper than ourself, which seems to be a big topic these days, doesn't it? I mean, when I was a kid, to think of computers was kind of like hard to figure out. But then to think that everybody would have a screen in their home, and then we would all make a page and it's all about me, so we could all send it out and learn about each other's self. The self is so much different. It's the way Ortberg puts it. He says the self is kind of like a standalone unit. It's just you, whereas the soul makes us and reminds us that we're not made just for ourselves. The soul, unlike the self, always stands before God. It's always before the Lord, and that's why we mention why we have hymns that say, then sings my self. It says, then sings my soul. That deep, almost, it's so deep, this human part of us, that it goes beyond words being able to describe, but yet we know it's there, and we say, then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee, how great thou art. That's what the psalmist said. He said, blessed the Lord, O my soul. This thing that integrates all that makes you, you, and that's probably why he follows that by saying, and all that is in within me, because that's what the soul is. It connects all these things that are within me. This depth to the soul, like I said, that goes beyond words. It's this thing that gives us the ability to love our family, to enjoy a sunset, or to grow in humility. Things that we know are so important, but they're all of our life center. They're the things that are most important, but it seems like especially the things that the Bible often points us to that are so important, we can't necessarily put under a microscope. We're not going to be able to see them on an x-ray, and I think that's why the Bible never is able to completely, totally describe or give a definition of what the soul is and why maybe we have such a variety of theological opinions on it. It's the deepest part of you. You know, there's a lot of things in the Bible that you can't totally understand, right? Like even the Trinity. I liked what A.W. Tozer said. He said, listen, I'd be kind of skeptical of a God that was small enough that I could understand everything about him. I like how Paul put it in Romans 11:33. He says, oh, the depth of the riches of both the wisdom and the knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and unfathomable are his ways. The bottom line is, Jesus said that you have this depth to you, this thing called the soul, that is absolutely the most important part of you, and how healthy you keep it will actually determine how well you handle this life and well you'll end up for eternity. We said that last week too. It's not just about a destination, it's about your diagnosis. When Jesus said, even if you gain the whole world, even if you got everything, was totally successful on the outside, if your soul is not in the right place on the inside, there's nothing all those great things on the outside can do to help the inside. On the reverse of that, if the inside is right, it's connected to God, and it's healthy, then you can handle whatever happens on the outside. It's your soul, and it's something that the Bible makes us to understand will never cease to exist. And it can become unbelievably good, or can become something that is unimaginably dark. It's the main thing that God sees, and when he looks at us, it's what matters most to him. Deuteronomy 4:9 says this, and I like the New American on this one because it does translate the Hebrew word soul there. It says, only take care and keep your soul diligently. It's not something that just happens. We have to be diligent. There's an old book by Oscar Wilde that's a fascinating book. Story. I never actually read the book, but I saw the movie on it, and I've watched it a couple times. A story of a man who sells his soul. Sometimes we talk about it doing that, right? And he sells it for ceaseless youth and beauty. He's going to be eternally young. He's always going to look young. He'll always look like he's somewhere in his mid-20s. But his beauty, even though he's healthy and young-looking and great-looking and handsome on the outside, it hides a soul that's marked by greed and lust and betrayal. And he has a painting made of him. This artist on a canvas makes a painting of him, a portrait of him. And so there's his picture on there because he's young. He makes a good portrait. But what happens is, it's kind of cool, is every time he does something, he sins or he does an act of greed or he does some form of betrayal or lust, it shows up on the canvas in the painting, like a pockmark or some like hideous feature or twisted feature that comes out on the painting. And as time goes by, he still looks great. But the painting is getting uglier and uglier and grosser to the point where it gets so hideous, it's freaking him out to look at it, and he goes up and hides it in the attic. And of course, eventually, death comes for him, and the painting is who he has really become. It's like the opposite of what Paul said was going on with him, right? Paul said in 1 Corinthians 4:16, he said, outwardly, we are perishing. Paul says, outwardly, I'm perishing or wasting away. The outward man is wasting away, but the inward man is being renewed day by day. Paul was a disaster on the outside. We don't know exactly what he looked like because the Jewish people were totally against imagery, and you never notice that. Like you've got statues of Caesar and a lot of the big famous Roman leaders and so forth, but there's no actual statues that the Jews made of Jesus or Paul or any of these people because they didn't believe in making idols. They literally took those commandments and stuck to them. But as more Gentiles got saved, it's kind of interesting. Non-Jewish people became to follow Jesus as the Messiah, then pictures would start appearing. And there are some early pictures of Paul in the catacombs that were painted, but it was still probably at least 100, probably closer to 200 years after he had died. But they think maybe tradition had gone forth and explained what Paul looked like. Who knows? But it's interesting because he's shown as a very short, bald little Jewish man who has a terrible posture, which historians says makes sense because of all the floggings and the beatings that he would have had, would have definitely damaged his ability to be able to stand up straight. So Paul's body was basically a rent-a-wreck. And he said, you know what, doesn't too much matter because my outward man is wasting away, but you know what, my inward man is being renewed day by day. Dorian Gray was just the opposite, wasn't he? The outward man was being renewed day by day, but the inward man was wasting away. And sometimes I wonder, you know, just like how Dorian Gray had that picture, if the condition of our souls was as visible as our bodies are, I wonder if we might conduct ourselves a little differently. We might be a little more serious about the way we take care of our souls. We don't have the painting like Dorian Gray did, but we do have the souls, according to the Bible. And if you want to know how well our soul is thriving, how well you're doing, you're going to have to devote some time to reflection and honestly thinking about taking care of my soul. Am I tending to it? No one's going to pressure you to do it. But the Word says it's absolutely imperative. Mickey Mantle admittedly lived a pretty crazy life. These guys partied all the time. It's kind of wild that they had such stellar careers, and they would play games completely hammered sometimes. I mean, just wild, you know. Paul, you probably know this. I mean, Mantle admittedly said sometimes he'd be smashed but still smash home runs. I mean, it's just wild, and he expected to die young. And he was quoted as saying that when he turned 60 on his 60th birthday, he said, "Geez, if I'd known I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of myself." But I wonder how many people will appear before God one day, and all we have to offer is our soul, and say, "Geez, if I'd known my soul was going to last this long, I would have taken better care of it. Probably would have taken it a little more seriously." As the saying goes, what matters most is not the accomplishments we achieve, but who we're becoming. Our problem is that this world doesn't do anything to help that. I mean, it just teaches us to pay attention to what matters around us. We circulate resumes that chronicle what we have accomplished and not what we have become. We have advertisements that we watch and conversations we hold and criteria by which we know we're going to be judged and the entertainment we consume, and it all inflames this desire to want to be able to change our circumstances and our situation while God waits to redeem our souls. The world has a lot of ways it keeps us from attending to our souls. Jesus told a story. It's a very familiar story. But I think in a way, he's telling a story about how important it is for us to take care of our souls and how there's so many different things that can damage our souls. It's probably considered one of his most important stories that he told, or parables. It's the first one recorded in the Gospel of Mark, and it's the only parable that commentators say that he fully interpreted. Some he would tell a little bit about it was what it was and what he meant, but in this one, he totally interpreted it, and that's the one about the farmer planting the seed, or the sower and the seed. I'm going to just read the story itself as he tells it, as Luke recorded it in his gospel. It's in chapter 8, verses 5 through 8. Again, I'm sure we all heard it, but let's just listen to it one more time. He had a crowd there, and in verse 5 it says, Jesus said that there was a sower, and he went out to sow his seed, a farmer who went out to plant seed. And he sowed some, and some fell, or he sowed the seed, and some fell beside the road, and it was trampled underfoot, and the birds of the air ate it up. Other seed fell on rocky soil, and as soon as it grew up, it withered away because it had no moisture. Other seed fell among the thorns, and the thorns grew up with it and choked it out. Other seed fell into the good soil and grew up and produced a crop 100 times as great. As he said these things, he would call out and say, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." So it's a story about seeds, a sower, and soil. And one of the things that I've heard that always helps me with parables is it says, look at the parable and see what the constants are, and then see what the variables are. And so in this one, we have the seed. That's a constant. It's not like there was good seed planted and bad seed planted. All the seed was good. And the one who's sowing it is very generous with it. He throws it out on all different kinds of situations and circumstances of the soil, and he scatters it everywhere. So the sower is constant, and the seed is constant, or the seed is constant, and the sower is constant. It wasn't a story about a bad farmer and a good farmer, or a bad sower and a good sower. It was a good sower. And he'd take the seed and he'd spread it wherever he could. The first thing we notice about him is how generous he is with everything. It's the soil that varies, isn't it? That's where it starts to get interesting. And I think the soil could also be looked at as our souls. Our souls. You could replace that word for soul. The closed soul is death, and the receptive soul is life. The first one is kind of a hardened soul. Right? It's that seed that fell beside the road. I mean, in Israel, it's such a dry climate that the ground can become pretty hard. It is. So if you're by a road where people are traveling all the time, it's going to become even harder. And so people are walking on top of that, and the seeds don't have a chance. It's too hard, and I think souls can get that way. I don't know if any of you bothered to watch it, but I got caught up in it. It was just two Saturday nights, and the second night was last night about Bernie Madoff. And man, that is just, it blows your mind how hardened this poor guy's soul got, that he, something like upwards of $65 billion that he had just taken. They showed this one lady from Germany that had invested $1.2 billion with them, and the whole thing was just gone. And I don't know how much they investigated him himself to make this movie. You know, I tried to look up that facts versus fiction thing, and they said economically it was pretty close, but of course nobody really knows how Bernie felt except Bernie himself. But what was also kind of scary is how much Richard Dreyfuss actually looks like him in his older age. But anyway, he was playing him, and the way he portrayed him is that he didn't have any, he never shed a tear about anything. And it was just frightening the way he portrayed it, and the realization that, you know what, a soul can actually get that hard. And then his wife was, his sons got rid of him. They turned him in, and then his wife was the only one left that would go visit him at jail. And then as soon as the book came out about that a lady wrote about an affair that she had with him, she never went to go see him again. And he's by himself, and 2 years to the day that he was arrested on December 11, 2008. On December 11, 2010, his son hung himself. And they still showed him that he didn't show any emotion. And it just kind of blew my mind. Like, wow, you know, can a soul get that hardened? But you know what? It's easy for us to look out at the world and you know, look at somebody else's hardened soul. But I'm like, how about me, man? You know, we as Christians can get hardened too. I'll tell you something. 58 years old, I'm going to be in August. It sometimes becomes a challenge. You get to this point where more of your life is behind you than the life that's left in front of you. And you realize that, you know what, certain things maybe just didn't pan out the way you thought they were supposed to. You know, certain ideas or dreams that you had, and what happens is you get these hurts and these disappointments, and you can start to get hardened yourself, and you put this protective shell, and it's like, you know, oh, I've heard that preached before, I've heard that taught before, you know, I've seen that study before, and it's like nothing can penetrate anymore, and you're just hardened, and everything's the same anyway, what's the use? And you just can get cynical and bitter and suspicious. And we can start to feel as though God has let us down, and we've got to be careful that we don't just start viewing things from a hardened heart, which is just conventional wisdom. We've got to make sure we're using God's wisdom, which is so inverted and so different from our own knowledge and wisdom and understanding. His wisdom is what? It's through the cross. It's a completely different way of viewing success. I mean, he was abandoned, he suffered, and he died. But guess what? The kingdom totally went forward. That's how the kingdom advanced. It went radically forward. So when we look at our circumstances and you feel that your hardening of soul is taking place and thinking that God couldn't be doing anything really good right now, the cross of Jesus Christ challenges you with that wisdom and just simply says, well, why not? Why couldn't he? He's done it before. The key is to not let our hearts go unexamined and let this hardness begin to come in little by little. It's very subtle. Works an inch at a time, a day at a time. I had an uncle that I think was one of the most unhappy people I'd ever known. He was so hard-hearted, I never knew him growing up to ever have spoken to his father. He didn't even go to his funeral. It's interesting the image Jesus chose, though, when it comes to the hardened heart. I mean, when you think of people this hard or how they get hard, and sometimes they're the most difficult people to deal with, And even we ourselves sometimes, and you think, well, you know what? There's some good imagery in the Bible that you would think Jesus would want to use when it comes to dealing with those kind of hearts. Like one of the prophets referred to the Word of God as a hammer, you know? That seems like that would make more sense. When we get to the hard soil, the hardened soul, let's bust out the hammer or the fire. Or Hebrews talks about the Word being like a sword, you know, two-edged sword. Let's go for that one. But instead, he doesn't. He still sticks with the imagery of a seed, the weakness of a seed. You throw that thing out, you could lose sight of it. But you know what? A seed starts out really weak, but all it needs is a little crack, man. You just give it a little crack. You notice that, right? How an acorn can just slip into the crack of a sidewalk. And you give it some time, you give it a little water, some sun, it starts to sprout up. A little more time and a little more time, that thing can grow and split aside all of that concrete from one side to the other. I mean, we love those instant conversion stories. And we say, well, look at the Apostle Paul, you know, on the road to Damascus. But I always say it really didn't happen that way. You know, there was about 12 hidden years that he was in Tarsus. It's interesting how so often the Bible uses a tree planted by the waters in Psalm 1 and so many other places, and a seed, often when it comes to the kingdom of God. Things that grow, people, take time. We need to give time and effort, and sometimes just to get a crack so that seed can get in here. And sometimes the best way to plant the seeds of God's Word is on your knees. Did you ever read this thing on your knees, a state of prayer? You know, God, I need more than just an academic exercise right now. I need you to say something to me. This soul's getting kind of hard. Keep it soft, Lord. Doesn't take a lot. So that was the first seed, the hardened soul. The next one is the shallow soul. Right? It says that there was rocky soil. And I used to think of that, well, you got all these rocks on the soil, right? And so it can't really take root. But one perspective I heard on it is that it's not necessarily that the soil's got all these rocks. It's just that it's a thin layer of soil, and underneath the soil is all the rocks. So that it can't really get a good root because it gets into that top little shallow amount of soil, but then it can't get down below that. Richard Foster said that superficiality, shallowness, is the curse of our age. I think it's true. Another guy, Richard Rohr, who's like a Franciscan frere. I mean, this guy's got a lot of time that he just spends on his soul. He calls us kind of an interesting phrase. He says, we're a circumference people. We've learned how to live on the surface, on the outside, and we never really get to the essence of what we're made for. And we live out here on the peripheral of life so long that we begin to think that that's what life really is, that that's the only life available. We remain in that place and we avoid reality. He said that people years ago, he thinks, found the essence and got to the core of life earlier because they didn't have all of these extra things to divert us, you know, whether it's television or computer or telephone or all these things. And life is just so hard that they had to get to the essence of life in order to survive. We've figured out how to do it without it. And it's so easy to just get sucked into. I mean, I know I often probably show more emotion over the state of a football game than I do the state of my soul. Not to mention the state of other people's souls. It's just easy to fall into. Sometimes we just live on the surface, and then what happens is we give a gospel on the surface. You know, because we want everybody to like it. You know, we want to keep it, don't make it too, we want acceptance rather than commitment. You know, so let's just kind of keep it out here on the circumference where everybody will be okay with it and it's not too heavy. And you know what? Jesus did just the opposite. When he told this parable, he told them, they said, like, Jesus, we don't understand what you're saying. Why are you saying it in such cryptic language? He said, because I only want the people that are really interested to come and follow me. Could you imagine I try to tell a sermon in some cryptic language so that only the people who are really interested will stick around? I mean, we're doing just the opposite, man. I want to make it as simple and as clear as possible. And Jesus was like, here's how he said it. When he talked to him, it says his disciples began questioning him as to what the parable meant. Well, what are you talking about, Jesus? And he said, to you it has been granted. I'm going to explain this thing to you guys to know the mysteries of the kingdom of God. But to the rest, it is in parables, so that seeing they may not see and hearing they may not understand. It was like a filter to filter out the people who weren't really interested in following him. It's kind of interesting that out of the four soils, three of the souls there, for various reasons, are not interested in Jesus. They're only interested in what they can get out of him. The first group gets nothing. The second group gets a little more. The third group gets quite a bit more. But as soon as they see that following Jesus is impeding and they get worried about all this other stuff, they're out of the game too. Somebody said a long time ago that the devil, if he can't make you sin, he'll make you busy. Man, just clutter your life so much that you don't have any time to spend on your soul. And he'll be okay with that because the end result is still the same. Your soul will just shrivel. Our world will divert your soul's attention because it's a cluttered world. It's just a dangerous situation because it's so subtle. It will take softness and depth, but the world won't help much. Again, Deuteronomy 4:9. Only take care and keep your soul diligently. Jesus says, it won't profit you anything if you gain the whole world and lose your own soul. And what will a man give in exchange for his soul? Man, that's a penetrating question. I mean, we basically just kind of stand silent. Because what do you say to that? I mean, do we know we don't have anything on the level of the value of our soul that we could ever possibly give in exchange for it. But God does. God says, I'll tell you what I have and I'm going to give in exchange for your soul. He says, I've emptied heaven of its most prized possession. God the Father basically spent the family fortune in exchange for our souls. God the Father gave His Son for our souls. So He says, don't let it get hardened. Tend to it. Don't let it get caught up in the superficiality of this world. And don't let it get crammed up and crowded with all these worries and working and worrying whether you have enough. He says, I gave my Son in exchange for your soul. That should be enough. You know, we can't assess our Christianity based on whether or not it's giving us enough comfortable life or not. Because you know what? Sometimes it just won't. But it'll give you something a lot more valuable. A healthy soul. A saved soul. That's why Jesus told us to do this every once in a while. He said, remember, what are you going to give in exchange for your soul? You can't, but I can. And when he came 2,000 years ago, what's amazing is he didn't come to bring judgment on us. He came to bear judgment on himself. I deserved judgment, for him to bring all this judgment on me. But instead, he bared it on himself. He took it on himself. That's why he said it's going to be my body, not yours, my body, broken for your sin.